Connection.com.
Major funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Back in 1966, Muhammad Ali was still fighting as Cassius Clay. The Sound of Music won Best Picture at the Academy Awards, and a nuclear physicist overheard a chance piece of advice being given to President Johnson about the Vietnam War. It might be a good idea, this military man told the president, to toss in a nuke from time to time just to keep the other side guessing. Well, that bit of advice led to a secret scientific study examining the use of nuclear weapons in Vietnam. The author's conclusion was, thankfully, don't use them. The report itself was just recently declassified. One of its authors is with me in the studio. Steven Weinberg won the Nobel Prize for Physics. He is a noted teacher and theoretical physicist. He's also one of the founders of the Union of Concerned Scientists. That's a group with 50,000 members concerned about the misuse of science and technology. Connection listeners, this hour we're talking about nuclear weapons. Can or should the nuke ever be considered a usable weapon? And what's at stake as the Bush administration considers deploying nuclear weapons on the battlefield? How are these changing ideas about the use of nuclear weapons likely to influence policies regarding proliferation and threat? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest in the studio is the physicist Steve Weinberg. Welcome to The Connection.
Good morning.
I'm wondering whether or not the declassification of this document caught you at all by surprise, coming as it did so many years after you were involved with it.
Oh, yes. I was very surprised. And the administration, the federal government, I should say, has an enormous warehouse full of classified documents, and they know they should mostly be declassified, but it just takes some effort to declassify a document, and it goes on year after year getting worse and worse, with eventually the whole planet will be classified documents that are waiting to be classified, declassified.
This one is called Tactical Nuclear Weapons in Southeast Asia. It was done in the mid-1960s, and your study was specifically on whether the sort of military side of whether or not nuclear weapons could be at all useful in North Vietnam?
Yes. We had heard rumors that the administration was considering, this would be the Johnson administration, was considering the possible use of tactical nuclear weapons in Southeast Asia. And from the beginning, I thought that would be a terrible idea. Quite apart from any question of military effectiveness, it would break the taboo against the use of nuclear weapons. It would destroy our moral position in trying to get other countries not to develop nuclear weapons. It was just the worst thing imaginable. But I didn't think that those arguments would carry much weight, because everyone has their own opinions about those things. So I thought that it would be good to participate in this study as a purely military exercise to see whether or not, in fact, they would be of any use. I strongly suspected that they wouldn't be of any use. And in fact, for ethical reasons, I wouldn't have joined the study if I thought it would come out with any other conclusion.
When you look at the military side of it, was part of your thinking at the time that the use of the first use of nuclear weapons there might in fact encourage either the Chinese or the Soviet Union to provide nuclear weapons to the North Vietnamese? Was that part of
yes,
the equation?
There were two parts. One was that the North Vietnamese didn't have any good targets. There really wasn't any great concentration of North Vietnamese troop strength or right. military infrastructure that would be useful to attack. There isn't just one Ho Chi Minh Trail that could be blocked by a single nuclear weapon. The Ho Chi Minh Trail is actually more like the capillaries in your hand. They spread out through miles and miles of inhospitable countryside. And a single nuclear, or even a few nuclear weapons could do nothing really to interdict travel from the north. The other part of it is what you asked me. We thought that if we started using them, it would be the most natural thing in the world that the Russians would supply tactical nuclear weapons to the North Vietnamese. The Chinese, much less so. They were somewhat hostile to the Vietnamese regime themselves, more for historical reasons than anything else. But the Russians would only be too glad to supply nuclear weapons. And with us having broken in the ice, there would be no political price for them to pay for using them. And we had lots of targets. That's what our study found. We had a great marine base in Da Nang, a large Air Force base at Tan Sanut Air Base, the American Embassy in Saigon, just all sorts of juicy targets waiting to be attacked with short-range nuclear missiles. We felt like someone who is that the United States would be like someone who wearing clothing that are soaked in gasoline and who's being attacked and decides to fight back with a flamethrower. It's not a good strategy.
Looking back almost 40 years when we consider that time, and a lot has changed since then. There is not just a nuclear club of five nations who have their little permanent member Security Council button on, but there are at least eight nations we know of that have nuclear weapons now, if we include Israel and India and Pakistan, North Korea, maybe, Iran, we don't really know. The principle of the taboo, it was a word that you used, the principle of the taboo against first use back in that study in Vietnam, does that hold as true today as it did back then, as it did in the Cold War?
I think it holds, but it's not that strong, and we should do everything we can to strengthen it. Proliferation is a serious problem. In addition to North Korea today, Iran tomorrow, we have, even in Brazil, a country that has no natural enemies to worry about, one of the members of the cabinet has recently called for the independent development of a Brazilian nuclear weapon. We need to fight against this. We have a non-proliferation treaty signed in 1970, which is a bargain. It's a bargain with the non-nuclear states on one hand and the nuclear states on the other, in which the nuclear states agree to give up the idea of developing nuclear weapons. The non-nuclear states, their quid pro quo, their bargaining chip, the nuclear states agree on their hand to de-emphasize the use of nuclear weapons.
More than that.
And
more
move
than
toward an eventual elimination.
That's right. And while we might be able to say that some of that was close to happening at the end of the Cold War, that part of the bargain is hardly even being considered. Now, the idea that nuclear states would do anything to move towards the eventual removal of all their nuclear warheads.
Some countries with a nuclear weapons program, like South Africa comes to mind particularly, have actually divested themselves of their nuclear weapons. Also, some of the successor states of the Soviet Union, which in the days of the Soviet Union had large bases on their territory. I'm thinking particularly of Ukraine.
Mm-hmm. Kazakhstan as well.
Yes, that's right. They voluntarily gave up those nuclear weapons and accepted inspection to verify that the nuclear weapons had been given up. This was particularly true of South Africa. So this sort of proliferation can also work, can also be reversed. But it's not going to be reversed if the Americans take the lead in showing to the world that nuclear weapons are not something that you're going to have to keep around perhaps unwillingly as a deterrent against some other country that might cheat and develop a handful of nuclear weapons. Right now I would agree that the idea of the United States divesting itself of all nuclear weapons is probably Well, it's visionary. It's hopeless. We don't see it in the immediate future. Well,
let's talk about what we are looking at.
But I do think a tremendous reduction in nuclear weapons on the part of the United States and Russia, who have many, many thousands of nuclear weapons left, down to some small number, just large enough so that we don't have to worry about becoming completely helpless in the face of a clandestine nuclear weapon in the hands of some rogue state, perhaps a few hundred, that's certainly doable. And there are no reasons in the world why we shouldn't be moving in that direction.
All right. But one of the things that I wanted to talk to you specifically about today are reports that we've been getting just in the last weeks and months from the Armed Services Committees, from the Pentagon, that there is strong pressure to remove a testing ban, that there is money set aside in the budget for something that's called a robust nuclear earth penetrator, some sort of small, low-yield nuclear weapon that could blow up a cave or an underground biological laboratory. In your view, is this a shift towards first use? Is this moving in the opposite direction from what you're talking about?
I'm afraid it is. I hope I'm wrong about that, but I'm afraid it is a move toward resurrecting nuclear weapons as something for use, which has often been the point of view of the military. General Eisenhower, I believe, just regarded nuclear weapons as just another weapon to be used whenever it was helpful to use it. I think that's just something we should not want to go back to. There are a number of straws in the wind. Some of them you mentioned. The administration in the nuclear posture review, on which I testified in the Senate, mm-hmm. Is calling for the development of a robust nuclear earth penetrator, if that's what the acronym stands for, which would be able to attack underground facilities using a low-yield nuclear weapon. Well, unfortunately, a robust earth penetrator would only work against a very small set of underground targets. You would have to know quite accurately where the underground laboratory was, not only how deep it is, but where it is horizontally in terms of latitude and longitude to a very high precision. Furthermore, if it's too deep, we can't get at it. If it's, a few hundred feet deep, we can get at it, but the nuclear explosive, which could destroy it at that depth, would inevitably produce an enormous crater that would vent nuclear material and dirt that had been made radioactive to the surface in a large cloud that could kill everyone within half a mile if the wind was still, and for many miles if the wind carried it downstream. So this is a... this is an idea of a weapon which can only be used under narrowly defined circumstances, which will inevitably produce a great deal of damage, indiscriminate damage affecting civilians.
Connection listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. More about new developments in the field of nuclear weapons and whether or not there's a double standard here for those who can and those who can't have nukes, and whether or not we're shifting a long way from the very principles of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection.
The world will note that the first atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, a military base.
That was President Harry S. Truman in a radio speech, August 9, 1945. This hour, we're talking about nuclear weapons with the Nobel Prize-winning physicist Steven Weinberg. The U.S. appears to be taking steps to increase its nuclear might. There's talk of low-yield weapons, lifting bans on underground testing, bunker busters. The moral complexity and the global power dynamics surrounding nuclear weapons are as old as the weapons themselves.
We won the race of discovery against the Germans. We have used it in order to shorten the agony of war, in order to save the lives of thousands and thousands of young Americans. We shall continue to use it until we completely destroy Japan's power to make war.
What does that sound like to you, years after it was broadcast on the radio, Professor?
Well, for a physicist, any mention of Hiroshima and Nagasaki brings profound ambivalence. On one hand, it really did shorten the war. There's no question. In fact, even after the second bomb was dropped, it was not easy to get the Japanese military to acquiesce in surrendering to us. And doubtless millions of people on both sides were saved. On the other hand, it's just so awful a device, and one we feel mustn't be used again. If somehow or other I could tinker with the laws of nature and make the fission of uranium and plutonium impossible, I would be glad to do so and lose the nuclear power program in the process. It would be a small price to pay. It's not possible. And Truman's announcement, there was almost a joke in it that we were attacking military targets in Hiroshima. We were attacking Hiroshima, period. And there was not any a sight of any more military targets than any other Japanese city. But that's what did end the war. So I don't know whether to laugh or cry.
And when we look at the situation today, I had pulled a couple of quotes of politicians. This is Secretary of State Colin Powell referring to the nuclear posture review that we were talking about. His remark is, what the Pentagon has done with this study is sound military conceptual planning, and the president will take that planning and give his directions on how to proceed. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, talking about these treaties, says, and I'm quoting him, arms control treaties are not for friends. How much is the situation changed today, and is it just the politicians? Is it just politicians who want this? Because there are young scientists, the 23-year-old Steve Weinbergs of today, who want to apply their minds to, you know, either the construction of new weapons or the development of nuclear science.
The idea that arms control treaties are not appropriate between friends, I think, is absurd, because unfortunately the military on both sides, on Russia and the American side, are frozen in a Cold War posture of being able to respond to a perceived attack by the other side within a matter of minutes so as to preserve their own nuclear forces. This means that the United States, year after year, is in a danger, a small danger on a year-to-year basis, but still a persistent, chronic danger of having our country destroyed, not just damaged, but quite destroyed by a mistaken launch by Russian missiles. And in fact, the Russians have made mistakes along this line, although certainly never going so far as to launch their missiles. In 1995, misinterpreting the firing of an American research rocket from a Norwegian offshore island as a submarine-launched ballistic missile from a submarine in the Sea of Norway, the Russian decision-making process on whether or not to retaliate started, and it was only stopped within a few minutes of their 10-minute deadline. We can't weather too many more mistakes like that. And that's one of the reasons it's so important for both sides to reduce their nuclear forces from thousands. The treaty that was signed was ratified in the Senate last 30, called only for a reduction to about 2,000 by the year 2012. We need to reduce the number to hundreds. And I'm afraid then we still will be facing the possible loss of millions of people in a mistaken attack, but at least it won't be hundreds of million.
Let's take our first caller from Durham, North Carolina. Alexander's on the phone. Hi, Alexander.
Hello.
Thanks for calling.
I just had an observation and a question. I know that nuclear weapons for many countries, especially for countries whose militaries are not that strong, are really the most cost-effective deterrent against an attack. And in that respect, I just wanted to ask whether the new Bush doctrine of a preemptive strike is not an incentive for countries to aspire to nuclear weapons, to seek those nuclear weapons so that they can better protect themselves.
I think that is, in fact, a problem. I don't think nuclear weapons carried by ICBMs being fired from some so-called rogue state is a serious threat, because I think there's so many other ways of getting nuclear weapons into our country. We have 17 million containers entering our harbors every year, freight containers, and it would be much easier just to put a nuclear weapon into one of those. We have very little security now.
Let me, if I can, though, stay with Alexander's point about those states. I mean, it's not too hard to penetrate the logic of the North Koreans, who see states like Afghanistan being bombed,
yes,
because
yes,
there are no deterrents. Iraq under threat, there is no nuclear deterrent. They see it perhaps as their one way to prevent.
Yes, I think it does have a function, and I agree with the caller, that although it has no other function, it would not be used just because they want to hurt us, because there's so many other ways of doing that. Nevertheless, if Afghanistan had nuclear weapons and ICBMs that could carry them to our shores, we might very well not have invaded Afghanistan. I have to agree with that. I think there are ways, but you know, even without ICBMs, we're deterred anyway, because they can use those nuclear weapons against our allies. In the case of North Korea, they don't now have an ICBM that can attack us. But they can use nuclear weapons as a deterrent by threatening Japan or South Korea. So we have the problem in any case, and I don't have an easy suggestion on how to get out of it, except that when they first start to erect their ICBMs capable of carrying nuclear weapons, that, together with the strong suspicion that they have some nuclear weapons, I think would justify us in launching a preemptive attack, not on their whole country, but on those weapons.
With nuclear weapons?
No, not with nuclear weapons, and it's not necessary to do with nuclear weapons. With conventional weapons, particularly cruise missiles launched from offshore, can do the job perfectly well. I think the world owes a debt to Israel in destroying the Osiris reactor in Iraq.
In Iraq, yeah.
What was it, 1982? And I think we should be ready to do that sort of thing again. I know Senator Byrd and Senator Kennedy have both come out strongly against the idea of a preventive attack. And I agree with them if a preventive attack means it may mean overthrowing the regime. But certainly I don't think there are any good reasons to be against a preventive attack in actually destroying ICBMs on the ground. So right, we do have that defense.
Let's go along if we can. Alexander, thanks for that call. To Fayetteville, North Carolina now. And Adam. Hello, Adam.
Good morning.
Thanks for calling.
It concerns me that what has been completely left out of this discussion is the fact that the United States, as I see, one of the reasons for the Bush's Bush policy of looking at testing some, different kinds of nuclear weapons again, is that the United States only has one alternative or one of the options when it comes to responding to weapons of mass destruction. Because, of course, as you all know, weapons of mass destruction to the U.S. are all the same, whether they're chemical or biological or nuclear. So
Adam, that the U.S. needs to move nuclear weapons into its active sort of battle armament to counter the threat of biological weapons?
Obviously, the political message would be, remember, for example, if we were to undergo an attack from a state-sponsored, some sort of state-sponsored, even if it's a rogue state, attack on a large scale by the chemical or biological weapons, the United States should have, as at least one of its alternatives, is to respond, en masse. And the only, you know, the U.S. does not have a chemical weapons or a biological weapons act, you know, offensive capability program. Our alternative is nuclear. And that is, there is nothing that should not be made about that message. Look, if any state wants to even think about coming near us with an attack of that sort, that this would be the response, if appropriate. And the U.S.
needs to
send that message.
This is the same sort of deterrence that existed during the Cold War. If the Russians were even to think of using a nuclear weapon, they knew what the United States would use in response. Are you talking about anything that's different? Exactly. But are you saying that we need to use that same level of deterrence? Or are you saying that nuclear weapons need to be moved forward, need to be made more available at a, you know, low yield nuclear weapons?
What I'm saying is that they need to remain an option as long as chemical and biological weapons exist and are proliferating at the rate they're proliferating now.
All right.
Well, we have now nuclear weapons of low yield. We've been testing we've had many, many tests of low yield nuclear weapons over the year. That's not a problem. Even if we reduced our nuclear forces by a factor of 10, which I'd like to see, we would still have an overwhelming nuclear deterrent. I think we would use it if the country were attacked, for example, by a plague that killed many millions of Americans, that we would regard that as seriously as a nuclear attack. But we certainly wouldn't and shouldn't use nuclear weapons if the attack took the form of the attack on the World Trade Towers.
See, this is where I need you.
We
to
didn't
be...
use nuclear weapons against Afghanistan. We have overwhelming conventional force.
But if those robust nuclear earth-penetrating bombs had been available to the Pentagon at the time when they were trying to find Osama bin Laden in the Tora Bora Mountains, one might assume maybe those would have been used. And the reason I'm going back to that is I'm wondering if you can plot the distinction for me between holding nuclear weapons as a form of deterrence and moving them beyond deterrence to possible use. How do you know when that line is crossed?
Well, I don't know anything for sure, but if we had robust earth-penetrating nuclear weapons at the time of the Afghanistan war of the sort that some people are trying to develop, it would have made absolutely no difference. The problem then was finding which bunker Osama bin Laden was in, not being able to destroy bunkers at random, and he probably wasn't in a bunker anyway. He was probably in a cave somewhere. The problem was one of intelligence. It was a problem of men on the ground. And even if we had intelligence that he was in a bunker 300 feet down that could only be destroyed with a robust earth penetrator, we would still have to have troops on the ground to verify that we had killed him. Furthermore, I don't know whether we would want to use nuclear weapons in Afghanistan that would cause uncontrolled radioactive fallout on the surface. I think that might have hurt our cause a good deal more than it helped us. I imagine that you can invent a scenario in which, in a narrow, limited sense, it would be to our advantage to have a nuclear, robust earth penetrator. I think the mind of man is ingenious enough to imagine such a scenario. I don't happen to be able to think of one, but perhaps you can. It doesn't matter. It isn't worth it.
1-800-423-8255 to Burlington, North Carolina now, and Rissa's on the line. Hi, Rissa.
Hi. I had a question. If you've ever read the Better Butter Battle by Dr. Seuss, it's about two countries who essentially keep developing worse and worse bombs and weapons, until they get to the point where they're both saying they're facing each other, holding the weapon, waiting to see who is going to drop it first. And what I wanted to comment on was that it seems to be the mindset of a lot of nations that having the biggest and best is the best defense as well as the best offense, and that seems to be the problem. Why everyone, you know, India, Pakistan, America, everybody has to have their own nuclear weapon because, hey, we have to have it if everybody else does. What is a good strategy to convince the leaders, including our own leader, that proliferation is really not in their best interest, that getting rid of it is actually the best thing to maintain security?
I think the best strategy to convince our leaders is to convince the people. Our leaders want to be reelected. I don't think any president in my memory has given a high priority to long-range issues of nuclear stability. Certainly no president has given high priority to the danger of mistaken launch. I think those things happen when there are political pressure for them to happen. And so a lot of, in particular, a lot of scientists try to talk about this. It's not always, I'm afraid I haven't read Dr. Seuss, but he's on our side too, I gather.
He is.
That's good to hear. We need, he's probably more effective than a lot of scientists. We do need to reduce arms. We need to de-emphasize arms. And we need to do a lot more than has been done. There is a recent nuclear arms reduction treaty between Russia and the United States, which is quite ineffective. And in fact, it allows both sides to preserve their weapons in warehouses. They just have to take them off the missiles and allows them to preserve the missiles. There was an agreement between Brezhnev and Clinton in 1984 to take our weapons off targeting the other side. We would agree not to be targeting Russia, and they would agree not to target us.
Reagan and Brezhnev in 84?
Oh, my goodness. No, it was 94. I'm sorry. It was Clinton and Yeltsin.
All right.
Did I say 84?
Yeah, that's all right.
Okay. Yes, it was 94. That was a bad joke because you can retarget in a matter of seconds. All the information is in the computer. You don't even have to reboot.
Connection listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. With me in the studio, Steven Weinberg, Nobel Prize winning physicist and founder of the Union of Concerned Scientists. A founder of the Union of Concerned Scientists. And we're talking about changes that we're watching in the U.S. nuclear policy. 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Legal Seafoods, committed to protecting threatened marine resources and...
You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. With me in the studio, Steve Weinberg, professor of physics and astronomy at the University of Texas in Austin, winner of the Nobel Prize in Physics in 1979, and one of the founders of the Union of Concerned Scientists. And when we started the... No, it was about 5 or 6 minutes ago. I asked you a question, and then we moved beyond it. But I'd like to come back to it, and that is that we can sit here and... you know, tut-tut the politicians for whatever policies it is that they make. But to what extent should we also be looking carefully at the scientific community? To what extent is there a debate among scientists about whether or not time and energy and effort and money ought to be going into, you know, the latest technology in a low-yield nuclear weapon, that sort of thing?
Scientists always disagree about everything. We're not monolithic. Generally speaking, I think the scientists who've taken the trouble to write about this, organize, join societies, are generally skeptical about the idea of developing nuclear weapons for use and related ideas like the anti-missile system. They've tried to... work through the arms control organizations like the Union of Concerned Scientists and the Federation of American Scientists. Sometimes they work through the actual learned societies like the American Physical Society. There's a recent American Physical Society report on boost phase intercept, which isn't out yet, but will be out next month, and I think we'll make some news. There is a recent National Academy of Sciences report on nuclear testing, written from a non-political point of view, just assessing technically the need for it and what can be done to hide it. It concludes that there isn't any need for it, by the way, but it's a rational analysis not based on political prejudgments. Then there are scientists on the other side, and some of them are in the universities, of course, although they're not very vociferous. But there are lots of scientists on the inside who are very actively pushing their point of view. In particular, at the weapons laboratories, there's been very strong pressure for continued nuclear testing. It's quite understandable, because after all, if you made your career the design of nuclear weapons and new nuclear weapons have to be tested, then you certainly would not want to live in a world where there was a ban on testing. But this is always true. I imagine that manufacturers of Sam Brown belts, which used to be worn by Army officers, probably at one time were politicking for the development of new Sam Brown belts as the secret to America's military problems. They have to be, and the problem is they have more expertise than anyone, and they also have access to secret material, which isn't always available to people outside, although I do have a top-secret clearance. I try to avoid reading secret material because then I'm more inhibited about what I can say. So there is a continued argument among scientists, but it's mostly between inside and outside scientists.
1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Natick, Massachusetts now. John's on the line. Hi, John.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks for calling.
Hi, Professor Weinberg. Just wanted to say that, you know, I'm 40 years old. I've been living in fear of this thing, you know, in some sense subconsciously or consciously for the last 40 years. I was in my mother's womb during the Cuban Missile Crisis. Interestingly enough, I got to spend 1996 to 1998 as a consultant to the Defense Special Weapons Agency and the Nuclear Weapons Defense Agency, as well as Livermore Labs and Sandia Labs, while working in the former Soviet Union. And one of the things I kept, you know, hearing and reading, even in the New York Times, is that there were 500 nuclear devices that were just basically lost, that nobody knew where they are, and they're actually just out there. I'm wondering what you know about that. What's happening as far as things like Nunn-Lugar and, you know, the really strong efforts that I think those guys probably should be considered for a Nobel Prize, because I thought that was a good approach, and it seemed to be working, but it's very frightening. And I wonder if our president is scared, and I wouldn't blame him if he was, but I wonder if fear could lead us into a self-fulfilling prophecy of Armageddon.
What do we know about what we don't know, I guess?
Yes, well, I'm awfully glad you asked that question and put in a plug for the Nunn-Lugar program. This is a program that was started in 1991. It's a bipartisan program, as shown by the names Nunn and Lugar, to help the Russians control their nuclear stockpile. They have about 1,000 tons of highly enriched uranium on hand, and about 150 tons of plutonium. The highly enriched uranium is particularly bad because it's fairly easy to make a nuclear weapon using highly enriched uranium. And, for example, the Hiroshima bomb was made that way. It had never been tested when it was exploded. The test was of the plutonium bomb, which was exploded at Nagasaki. That's harder to do. That program is not being funded adequately. It's, according to the Baker-Cutler report, another bipartisan task force, the Nunn-Lugar program is getting, if you read their figures, it's getting about a third of the funding it needs on a year-to-year basis. And in fact, the president in the previous budget had even called for a cut in it, although now he's calling for a small addition. So far, we have only managed to secure about 1/7 of their highly enriched uranium. It's not under good control. You know, in Russia, things are continually breaking down. The storage facilities don't pay their power bills, and so the power company cuts off the power to the electrified fence. People don't get paid their wages. It's a miserable situation. Only about 40% of the nuclear sites have had suitable security installed, things like burglar alarms and electrified fences. That's a considerably more important program than anything that the Department of Defense is doing. And it's being continually underfunded.
Do you think we're heading into a self-fulfilling prophecy of Armageddon?
Well, I don't think it's self-fulfilling. I think the more we prophesy it, the less likely it is to happen. I think the problem is that the country is getting complacent, like the man who has jumped off the Empire State Building and has suffered no harm at all after he falls the first 70 floors. We're getting complacent. And I think the more talk about Armageddon, the better. But I don't think it's an Armageddon which developing robust nuclear earth penetrators or missile defense has any relevance to.
But how does it change this country's authority to say anything to other countries about their right or ability to build or control or to own or to sell nuclear weapons?
Well, that was the bargain made in 1970 that the other countries wouldn't develop nuclear weapons, and in exchange we would work toward de-emphasizing them and ultimately eliminating them. We're not now, according to what you hear from administration spokespersons, we're not now living up to our side in the bargain, and nuclear proliferation is going on. I think the world in many ways is more dangerous now than it was in the Cold War.
Do we need some new rules, some new system? At least, as you point out, during the Cold War, there were two sides who could, if they chose to, sit down across a table and talk about strategic limitations of their nuclear weapons. Now, when nobody's really certain what's being developed and where, and with the United States advancing the technology, is there a forum? Is there a method, a treaty way of saying, phew, this is getting out of hand?
I don't know any simple way. I think there are lots of things we can do that improve the situation on the margins. Just getting rid of most of the nuclear weapons would be an enormous help, because then what is at stake would be far less. Being very active about nuclear proliferation would be good. Increasing our spending on homeland security in many areas, in particular controlling container ships coming into our harbors in a much better way than we do now. But there's no single answer, and there's no answer that I can point to that will solve the problem.
You know, I was thinking about talking to you and trying to plot where this country's been over the past few decades, and wondering what you'd say to the suggestion that there is a drift towards nuclear weapons. There is an unwillingness to restrain either the science or the politicians at times of fear, that your colleagues were in the thick of this in the mid-50s at the early years of the Cold War, that it came back to life in consideration of the report that you did during the Vietnam War. And here we are also at a time when people are feeling very uncertain about their future or their security, and there seems to be very little restraint against the committees and the scientists and the Pentagon advisors who are saying, hey, let's take a look at this again.
When President Bush was asked why he was going to abrogate the anti-ABM treaty, the 1972 treaty that had banned anti-missile systems on both sides, he said, because the future is uncertain, we may need them. He's right. That sentence was half right. The future is uncertain. But it doesn't follow that the way to deal with uncertainty is to have more and more weapons, because they may create just the situation that you fear. When we develop an anti-missile system because the future is uncertain, shouldn't we also take into account the uncertainty about how the Chinese are going to respond, how they're going to build up their nuclear forces? Are we going to be better off or worse off? The problem is the fallacy of the last move, that you face a military uncertainty that you solve by adding new weapons, and then the world may be more dangerous than it was before. I don't think that unrestricted spending on every nuclear program that anyone can think of is a way of reducing uncertainty. I think we have to just live with uncertainty and do our best, but on a project-by-project basis, without this automatic falling over and giving up all resistance to administration's programs if they can point to a danger from some part of the world. There was strong opposition to the anti-missile system developing before September 11th, both on the part of the public and on the part of the Senate. And it collapsed after September 11th, even though September 11th, if anything, was a beautiful example of how vulnerable we are to threats that have nothing to do with missile defense. We mustn't behave that way. We have to look at each proposal on its merits and not just give them all a go-ahead because we find the world a frightening place. The world is a frightening place, and it's going to go on being a frightening place for a long time. But it's not going to be helped by a mindless acceptance of everything that our administration says it wants to do.
We began the program by talking about a study on technical nuclear weapons that was declassified a couple of months ago. You helped write that study. Were you glad that it was declassified?
I was so glad that it was declassified, partly because I could read it again for the first time in 40 years. I don't have a classified storage facility in my office at the University of Texas. But also, more important, because at the time it came out, although the study itself was classified, the title of the study, Technical Nuclear Warfare in Southeast Asia, and the list of authors was not private, was not secret. It was made public. And
it sounded like you were one of those people either
right.
advising or promoting it.
In fact, when I was just then in the process of leaving Berkeley to come here to Boston, and when I went back on a trip to Cambridge, Berkeley, people said that on the sidewalk in front of the house that I had lived in at the time the report came out, someone had scrolled Steven Weinberg, war criminal. Well, at least this report shows that our heart was on the right side.
Steven Weinberg, thank you so much for coming and spending an hour with us today.
Thank you very much.
Steve Weinberg is a professor of physics and astronomy at the University of Texas in Austin and one of the founders of the Union of Concerned Scientists, also winner of the 1979 Nobel Prize for Physics. Connection listeners, feel free to continue this conversation online. We're at theconnection.org. Look for our forum pages. Tara Murphy is our senior producer. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. To purchase cassettes and CDs of The Connection, please visit www.theconnection.org or phone 1-800-909-9287.
This is WBUR. Coming up next in the second hour of The Connection with Dick Gordon, A Bronx Tale. We're funded by you.